Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Richard Miniter filling in for Frank Gaffney at Secure Freedom Radio. Frank is off, as usual, saving the world. We're joined now by Rebecca Heinrichs, who's a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and she's here with some surprising news. You thought the sequestration battle was over. Well, folks, it's not. Rebecca, why do we still need to stop sequestration?
Well, we're just going to begin to see the effects of it on the military. That's what I'm really concerned about, is how badly it's going to harm military readiness. Now, the administration has done a pretty good job at framing this debate in terms of taking money from the poor and food stamps from the poor, or the, you know, making the military industrial base this big thing that makes the companies rich. And that's actually not what this is about. This is about actually harming the military readiness of our armed forces. And it's a really dangerous thing, and Congress still needs to work really hard to overturn what sequestration is about to do.
Now, when you say readiness, I mean, a lot of people outside of Washington especially don't understand the jargon. What you mean by readiness is that most military units must train constantly, rehearsing tank movements, infantry movements, and so on, not just to reduce injuries to the soldiers should they ever be put into combat, but also so that they are ready to go to rescue hostages or to do what they need to do in protecting the United States. And if you don't practice regularly, you don't maintain your equipment, you're not able to do those things when you're called upon in an emergency.
That's exactly right. And we're talking about training our forces. We're talking about the exercises that they do constantly so that they're ready and prepared in terms of their training. But we're also talking about, here's another jargon for you, but you should know it. It's procurement. That means buying weapon systems, satellites, tanks, airplanes, ships, the things that the military needs to make sure that we're actually demonstrating a force and that we can actually deter conflict in the first place and then actually defeat aggression in the event that deterrence fails and aggression does attack the United States or our allies. All of that is a part of military readiness. And we had the previous Secretary of Defense, who was actually President Obama's Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, who actually said that if sequestration happens, that it will actually hollow the force and create a readiness crisis. And that's actually what we're going to see here in the coming months. It's going to happen over the next 9 years if we don't do something about it. We're going to begin to see effects that in sequestration, that means less airplanes, less satellite systems, less tanks, less military hospitals, training facilities, and training hours for our men and women in uniform.
That's right. And that would take us back to a situation that we had in the mid to late 1970s, where we had a military that was so poorly paid that many of them were getting on welfare and food stamps, and there were real readiness crises. And we saw the effects of that when President Carter sent them in to rescue the 52 American diplomats held in Tehran in the embassy there, that the mission Desert One was a disaster, taking the lives of a number of servicemen and not getting anywhere near saving the hostages. So this readiness, it sounds like an abstract concept, but it's something that's like calling the ambulance. You need to be ready when the emergency strikes. But Rebecca, there are a lot of libertarian critics and conservative critics of defense spending who say, well, the Department of Defense is a government entity just like any other government entity. In fact, it's the post office with guns, they say. There's so much waste at the Pentagon that a 10% cut isn't the end of the world. And the people, Bill Kristol and yourself, Rebecca Heinrichs, who say, we can't possibly live with a dime out of every dollar being cut from the Defense Department. It's just ridiculous. They just sound like special interested people who just want to defend the budgets of their favorite programs. How do you respond to that?
Sure. That's one of my favorite topics when it comes to this subject. Here's the bottom line. The United States has a budget problem because of entitlement spending. It's Social Security, it's Medicare, it's Medicaid. That's what's actually driving up the federal budget. Yes. Is there some areas in the defense budget where we can actually cut some fat out and actually cut some waste? Absolutely. As a matter of fact, over the past 4 or 5 years, we've actually cut $1 trillion of the Defense Department budget. So this isn't new. This is cut on top of what we've already done to find efficiency savings. So now we're actually cutting into meat and bone. This isn't just waste. Now, another thing about sequestration is it doesn't allow us to use a scalpel and say, you know, we can find savings here and probably here and here. All it does is it takes an across-the-board cut to every single program, every single thing that we're actually spending the budget. So that's what I mean whenever I say satellites, planes, things that we've actually deemed necessary in order to actually execute these military operations and to sustain the peace. The other thing I'd like to say for those who are really concerned about the budget, just as I am, I'm also a fiscal conservative, what we need in order to get this economy back on track, in order for people to actually have some confidence in the market, is to have stability. What gives us stability? Peace. If the military is unable to deter conflict in the first place, and as quickly as possible, defeat aggression whenever it pops up. If we're not able to do that, we will have a completely unpredictable market in which people won't want to invest in the United States of America. That is the worst thing that we can have.
And in fact, war can be hugely expensive, and much more so than would be saved by this 10% cut. We're living in a dangerous world these days. We have the North Koreans announcing just today that they're restarting their atomic reactor at Yangdong, that they are pulling out of a number of treaties they signed as recently as 2007, pledging to disarm. You have the Iranians saying that they're going to continue to enrich uranium, and Iran remains the world's largest sponsor of terrorism. You have Venezuela. Now, Chavez is dead, but remaining an anti-American satellite in our hemisphere, which is continuing to fund terrorist groups, including the FARC in Colombia, and make money off drug dealing, which it then recycles into extremist activity. So the world is becoming, if anything, a more dangerous place. China and Russia on the move. These are themes that Frank Gaffney is constantly sounding on this program. In the face of all of this danger, is now the right time to really cut?
No, of course not. And I would actually argue that it can't possibly be a coincidence that you have an administration right now, when President Obama, who has dedicated himself to cutting the defense budget, disarming the United States in terms of our nuclear force. He has not agreed to actually modernize the nuclear weapons we have, and yet he wants to continue to decrease the number that we have. He has cut our missile defense system, even though ballistic missiles are becoming the most popular weapon to pose the most threatening threat to the United States of America in Iran and North Korea. And so you see the United States actually disarming. We spent the past 4 years, almost five now, disarming. Now we're going to cut the defense budget. And at the same time, you see these threats increasing. The fact of the matter is, the world is safer when the United States is stronger. And the world becomes more unstable and more of a scary place, unpredictable place, when the United States actually begins to disarm. So I think what you see now in the Obama administration, they're really scrambling now to get control of the Korean Peninsula. Things are unraveling quickly. And the administration has to understand that this is in part, not certainly entirely, but in part because of their failed policies with North Korea and the United States actually not demonstrating the will to defend the South Koreans and our friends in the Pacific region. So it's a scary place, and I'm just hoping that the Congress can get smart and try to figure out that now is not the time to cut the defense budget.
And the photographs coming out of North Korea in the last few days, including the one with its new maximum leader standing before a map of the world showing North Korean missiles hitting New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, that should be a clear enough illustration that the world remains a dangerous place, not just for our allies who are nearby, but for us at home, that the North Koreans, the Iranians, and others still wish to strike us. And as does Al-Qaeda, which has launched massive attacks across the Middle East and North Africa. Some 20 U.S. embassies have been overrun since September 2012. And, of course, let's not forget the four dead in Benghazi. So the world remains dangerous every place you look, and yet the Obama administration seems determined to cut. Assuming that there are rational people in the White House, and I do believe there are, why do you think that is? Do you think there's such a desire to feed the base constituencies that make up the core of the president's support, the unions, entitlement programs, and so on, the desperate desire for money to feed the people who vote for him? That's why we're cutting defense. Or do you think the president sees the world in a different way than maybe you and I do, where he sees it as much less dangerous and much more rational? Which of those things do you think it is?
I actually think it's a little bit of both. I mean, his party does believe that the United States should prioritize some of the entitlement spending programs, and you're going to try to balance the budget or kind of decrease the amount of spending or the debt, and you got to take it from somewhere. So they're looking at the Defense Department as the place to actually pay their bills so they can go along with their social agenda here at home. But the other part of the equation is the president and his supporters and administration do see the world fundamentally different than the way you and I do. It seems like they believe that the rest of the world must think the way we think, like Americans think. Surely the North Koreans wouldn't be so crazy as to launch a weapon at the United States. Surely the Iranians wouldn't do such a thing. But here's the thing. The North Koreans don't think like Americans. If they fought like Americans, their people wouldn't be starving across the country, and they wouldn't be making these erratic, completely horrifying threats to the United States. So they do think differently. They do not value the lives of their citizens the way Americans do. And so we can't count on them to act the way we would act in that same situation. So what we need to do is prepare, build up defenses so that we can go about our lives living in a flourishing society and that we don't have to fight wars. Part of making sure that we don't actually have to engage in a huge global conflict like we saw in World War II is that we provide peace and stability and we let the entire world know, our allies and our foes, that the United States will defend our people. And what the administration is doing is it's sending the opposite message.
That's right. And let's not forget, it's always good to page through the books of history, that when man landed on the moon in 1969 under a Republican president named Nixon, who later became infamous, there were many in Congress on the left who thought the entire space program, including the historic first landing of humans on the moon, was a waste of money and that money could have been spent on entitlements programs that supported their voters. So we still have that stream inside the Democratic Party that no matter how important other priority is, never does quite measure up to the needs of their voters. We're joined by Rebecca Heinrichs of the Heritage Foundation. This is Richard Miniter filling in for Frank Gaffney.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
Do you see that doggy in the shelter?
Hi, I'm Buddy, that adorable puppy you adopted from the Humane Society.
Meow. I'm Whiskers, a fluffy kitty, just waiting for someone to love me.
When you adopt a pet, we hope your new furry friend will become a cherished member of your family. And as Buddy and Whiskers will tell you, the key to success is following the rules to love by.
Woof, that's right. Please give me food, water, and exercise every day. To stay healthy, I need the same kind of things you need.
Talk to me. I like hearing your voice.
You're my best friend. Please don't stay mad at me or lock me up as punishment. Remember, I'm probably going to live 10 to 15 years, so take care of me when I get old.
One day you'll need someone to take care of you, too.
A message from the Montgomery County Humane Society. Visit www.mchumane.org for the complete rules to love by.
Be your best friend for life.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying we're serious about really cutting the budget.
As a backdrop
to this debate about 2011, people make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
And this is Richard Miniter filling in for Frank Gaffney. I'm here now with Andy McCarthy, and of course, he's no stranger to this audience, former federal prosecutor and regular contributor to National Review Online, and seems to turn up at every important and interesting conservative event. Welcome to the program, Andy.
Rich, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be talking to you again.
Now, it seems like Hamas is winning this fight. I mean, this column that you have, shh, don't tell anyone, Hamas has won, you know, unfortunately seems dead on the money. Do you think this is a matter of administration policy? Do you think the Obama administration is sort of tacitly pushing Israeli-Arab relations in this direction?
I'm not even so sure it's tacit anymore, Richard. You know, I think they're pretty aggressive about it. For all the lovey-dovey external stuff we saw between Obama and Netanyahu, if you look at the trajectory of policy over 4+ years now, it's clear, I think, two things have happened. Number one, the administration came in sort of bent on recalibrating the American relationship with the Middle East to one of, as it perceived it, where we were staunch allies of Israel, to something more along the lines of an honest broker, and maybe even tilting slightly toward the Islamist side on the theory that, you know, they had been underrated or undersold for so long.
So the Obama administration wanted us to actually be what we've often pretended to be in the past, especially in the Carter years.
Yes, exactly right. And a lot of us, I think, complained about this whole idea that America should be an honest broker between a totalitarian, freedom-killing system versus a strong ally of the United States, why you should feel like you need to be, an objective, dispassionate referee between those two sides is beyond me.
Well, it's because too many people read Immanuel Kant's plea for universal peace in college, I think. This idea that deep down everyone is rational and that, like a private gentleman's club in London in the 18th century or something, that everyone can sort of get along once they see the reasonable point of view of the other side. Of course, this just isn't the case when you look at Hamas and where they've come out clearly for killing people, without bother of a trial, by the way. I mean, all this hair pulling in the Obama administration about whether that's okay to strike people with drones without a warrant or a trial, Hamas seems to do it and not lose a moment's sleep.
Yeah, the amazing thing to me is that, you know, they are very representative of what the value system is in their civilization, and yet when their operatives operate in the United States, and Hamas, which is the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, has the cheerleading and aiding and abetting assistance of various Muslim Brotherhood front organizations in the United States, they really presume to use American liberties against us. And, you know, it never even seems to dawn on people in the West that the standards that they want to use against us wouldn't last 5 minutes in their own culture. So, for example, you know, in Mecca and Medina, non-Muslims are not deemed fit to set their feet into these major cities, and nobody's supposed to have a problem with that.
In fact, there are warning signs in multiple languages telling non-believers not to enter these cities.
Right, exactly right. And, you know, look at what the operating premise of the so-called peace process in the Middle East is, that there can be no Israelis living on Palestinian soil. And yet Israel is supposed to be not only, an open society to Arab Muslims, but, you know, open to the point of its own destruction.
And even those Palestinians who sold their land have a right to return, and the Israelis who bought it don't have a right to stay. It's a very inverted kind of reality.
Right, and who wouldn't want to be an honest broker between those two things?
Exactly, I mean. But getting back to what you're saying, I mean, using our institutions against us. I mean, it strikes me that on 9/11 they used our aircraft against us, and that ever since 9/11 they've been using our institutions against us. I brought this up to Clarence Thomas a couple of years ago at a small dinner, and I said, "Are you concerned about Brandenburg v. Ohio?" And he's like, he sort of scratched his head. He says, "You mean the 1969 case about free speech?" I said, "Well, that's a case in which." The KKK called for violence, and they was prosecuted under the syndicalism laws of Ohio. And those laws were overturned with an ACLU appeal at the U.S. Supreme Court. And he goes, yes, I know the history. And I said, well, do you realize that the only people citing those cases after 2001 are Islamists and the lawyers representing them?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. In fact, on the basis of those cases, I remember having an argument when I was a federal prosecutor in New York. Internally in the office, we were having a debate about whether merely being a member of Al-Qaeda was something that you could prosecute in the United States. And I thought it was, because I thought that the essence of the Al-Qaeda agreement is to kill Americans, so you couldn't be a member of that conspiracy without agreeing to that end, which is a terrorism crime under American law. But there are a lot of people in the Justice Department who believe that that line of cases, of which Brandenburg is really the top of the pop, so to speak, under it, it's no longer prosecutable in the United States to be a member of an organization that calls for the violent overthrow of our society. And that's I would say that I was in a definite minority, that is the majority opinion of not only the legal profession in the United States, but I think even in the Justice Department, certainly during the Clinton days.
Yeah, that's right. These enlightened liberal views in the legal elites, especially at the Justice Department, are what Islamists find so helpful. I mean, if the membership in a terrorist group, which is actively at war with the United States, in fact, between 1996 and 2001, al-Qaeda declared war on the United States six times in public press conferences called with newspapers and television stations from various nations. I mean, they're very open about it. Of course, they also declared war through their actions attacking the United States. And yet still, after 9/11, you're having these arguments that, mere membership in this group does not cause anyone to have any liability for the actions of that group. It's simply incredible. It's hard to believe that we were a country that used to shoot unarmed drummer boys of the enemy in our revolution in the War of 1812 and the Civil War. And yet now we find it hard to go after people who are actively working to kill civilians.
Yeah, that's what they call evolution. You know, when you evolve into such chaos that you can no longer defend the country. And you know, as you were going through that litany, it occurred to me that the only difference between most of the time you're talking about and now is that the people who were carrying those banners for all those years are now in the Justice Department making policy.
That's right. I mean, this was a stack of ACLU cases. I mean, maybe some conservative-minded public interest law firm needs to challenge those cases and rethink them in the light of terrorist attacks. I think when the Supreme Court ruled in 1969 in Brandenburg, they just weren't thinking about an organized foreign terrorist effort. They were looking at the activities of unions, communists, and the KKK, which had similar methods of operation, but were all generally composed of American citizens. This is a group that would be or al-Qaeda, and groups like it, Hamas, Hezbollah, and other Salafi extremist groups, are largely organized and funded from abroad. They do their recruiting here. They do some fundraising here. But they're directed from abroad, from a movement that's at war with the United States, literally at war.
Yeah, and back in the Second World War and the aftermath of that, the Supreme Court of that era warned against exactly what the Supreme Court has permitted since 2004. They basically talked about the craziness in terms of trying to defend the country, of the idea that you would invite enemies of the United States to use the courts of the American people to hold to account the people who were waging a war that was supported by the American people and called for by their representatives. I mean, you can't even, if you take a step back and think about it in those terms, you know, the idea that our own courts are used as a weapon against us in wartime, it really is hard to wrap your brain around how you protect a country that way.
Well, it's only a weapon because we give it to them, Andy.
Yep. No, exactly right. In fact, you mentioned the conservative lawyers. When a number of us complained about the activities of some of the Obama administration lawyers and pointed out what they had been doing in private practice, I think I called them the Gitmo Bar. I may have been the first to do that and refer to the lawyer left. When we were attacked for pointing these things out, a lot of the attacks came from the Republican side of the aisle, who, you know, basically limed the lawyers in a heroic way as if they were carrying out the traditional function of defense counsel, as if it were a traditional function of the American legal profession to bring lawsuits on behalf of the enemy in wartime, which is just preposterous.
That's right. In fact, it's just, even in the Vietnam era courts that idea was rejected. We've been talking to Andy McCarthy on Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney. This is Richard Benedetto filling in. Andy, thank you so much. Always fascinating talking to you.
Thanks, Rich. Take care.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It is with sound mind and body that I, James Fredericks III, after fighting with all direct family members for decades, leave my entire fortune of $32 million to the one friend I had in the end, the package delivery guy, Matt Sanger.
I had a feeling about this. I'm rich! Oh, this cannot be happening.
Actually, it's not happening.
What?
And it never will.
I don't get it.
There aren't even people here. That's just one of those murmuring sound effects.
Seriously?
Listen, if you want to have money in your future, don't rely on luck.
Huh.
Put $10 away each month. Cook once in a while instead of eating out.
Okay.
Pay down your high-interest credit cards.
Right.
Small changes today, big bucks tomorrow.
So, no inheritance?
No. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
And just to be clear, no inheritance, right?
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. North Korea today declared that it will restart a mothballed reactor that once put it in the nuclear weapons business. Its closure was supposed to be proof that Pyongyang was prepared to get out of that business, and it was handsomely rewarded by the West for doing so. The reactor is obsolete, and it will probably take time to restart. The mere fact that North Korea is willing to try, however, is a reminder of the futility of seeking to buy better behavior from despotic regimes that delight in duping us and being paid for it. Needless to say, this ominous episode, and more likely to follow it, should put an end to President Obama's dangerous notion that the world will be rid of nuclear weapons if only we continue to eliminate ours. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted, and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
This is Richard Miniter filling in for Frank Gaffney at Secure Freedom Radio. We're joined now by Benjamin Weinthal, a research fellow at the Foundation of Defense of Democracies. He joins us from Berlin. Benjamin, you've discovered this incredible case in Cyprus in which a self-confessed Hezbollah operative who's been duly convicted in the Cyprus courts. I guess they still have time to administer justice there when dealing with that financial panic. And yet so far, I think he only got a 4-year sentence. First of all, why was the sentence so light?
Well, I think one problem is Hezbollah, the Lebanese militia, is not a designated terrorist organization on the small Mediterranean island, as well as not within the EU. So the Cypriot authorities last year had to reduce his charges from terrorism charges to criminal offenses.
And so it's kind of like the way the Germans punished the guy who stabbed Monica Seles in the back on the tennis court with 3 months in prison, that this is an idea of European humanity.
There is a lot of laxity, I guess, to put it in diplomatic terms, about how the Europeans deal with, especially in the terrorism sector, how they're prosecuting these types of crimes. I mean, for example, look at Bulgaria right now. A Bulgarian national was killed by Hezbollah last July, and two operatives also killed 5 Israelis and injured 32 Israelis in the Burgas bus bombing. And the Bulgarian authorities are not willing to submit an application to Brussels, the head of the center of the EU, to place Hezbollah on the terrorist list.
Even the British have not done so, and they're usually pretty good at recognizing terrorism when it doesn't wear an Irish face. But even when the Hezbollah was targeting British soldiers in Iraq, the British government, the most they could do was to sort of ban the military wing of Hezbollah. Now, you refer to it as a Lebanese militia, but it is in fact an Iran-backed group that happens to be based partly in Lebanon. And Hezbollah has killed more Americans than any other terrorist group except for al-Qaeda.
That's correct. It is an Iranian-sponsored terrorist organization. And the British made what I would call a distinction without a difference. They banned the military wing, but they allowed the political wing to operate. And the only country in Europe that's banned the entire organization is Holland. But Hezbollah basically has wide latitude to raise funds here and to use those funds to attack American soldiers and allied soldiers in Iraq and other countries. So, you know, the question is whether the EU has the guts to include Hezbollah on the terror list. The talks right now are leaning toward just banning the political wing, but even Hezbollah, all the top leaders have said there aren't two organizations, we're one monolithic organization.
Well, right. In fact, doesn't Hezbollah mean Army of God in Arabic? I mean, they're pretty clear about what their goals and missions are and their ideology, and they're very clear about their commitment to violence to achieve political ends. But I'm kind of wondering why Europe finds such a hard time to recognize Hezbollah for what it is, especially when Hezbollah is so clear about it itself. And what I'm thinking is that maybe that so many people in government across the 25-nation European Union had ties to the student resistance movements in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, or the nuclear freeze movement and so on. And they sort of imagine that Hezbollah is a bit like they were in their youth, sort of against society and calling for reform, but basically deep down humanitarian and somehow center-left in their orientation. And maybe just by process of imagination and self-identification, that's what's driving a lot of these decision-makers. Do you think there's a psychological cause to Europe's softness on Hezbollah?
Richard, that's a very interesting point. I mean, I don't think the major news organizations in the West or in Europe on the continent here have delved into that social psychological factor that you just outlined. And I do think a lot of the journalists and many politicians tend to view Hezbollah as sort of a Bonnie and Clyde organization. And, you know, it's sort of a group of cognitive behavioral social workers who are trying to help the Lebanese population. And they use these phrases like resistance and have failed to get behind the rhetoric and really analyze the fact that Hezbollah is murdering Europeans, murdering tourists on European soil. And that plays into, I think, a sort of soggy European appeasement policy toward many of these radical Islamic groups.
It's interesting that, you know, so much political violence in Europe tends to come from the left. I mean, if you go back to the 1980s, you look at the Red Army Fraction, the Bader-Meinhof gang, and so on. And now we're seeing in this decade in Europe violence coming from the Islamists who are allied more or less with the hard left. Do you think this is a sense among European decision makers, especially those not so much from the Social Democratic Party in Germany, but from maybe the Green Party or parties that are just barely too small to get representation in the various elected bodies, that out of those groups there is great sympathy for this resistance, so-called resistance of Hezbollah, and that maybe also they don't realize that to an extent to which it is in fact directed by various Iranian intelligence organizations?
Without question, I mean, remember here in Germany, in the Bundestag, of the over 600 members of parliament, there are 80 representatives or a bit more from the German Left Party. Many of those representatives, including the foreign policy spokesperson, participated in a pro-Hezbollah rally in 2006 where folks were chanting, "We are all Hezbollah." That's when Hezbollah fired rockets into Israel and Israel responded with self-defense measures, and that brought about the second war in Lebanon. And then you have the Green Party here again, which was part of a coalition government. It's not a fringe party. Back with the Social Democrats up until 2009, I believe, they were a coalition partner with the Social Democrats. And the head of the party right now, a woman named Claudia Roth, one of the heads of the party, just high-fived Iran's ambassador at the Munich Security Conference. It was caught on video, and you can watch it online. Reuters caught it. he was accused by Iranian Kurds of massacring Kurds in a province in Iran when he was the governor. So you have a very weird alliance taking place between, on the one hand, the Greens and leftist parties and Hezbollah and at times Hamas and the Iranian regime.
And that's right. And the Green Party itself kind of has a violent origin, too, in the 1980s in Germany, where there's continuing rumors that it was funded by money from the East, either East Germany or further east, Soviet Russia in those days. But some of those demonstrations over cruise missiles in Europe got quite violent. And if you read the publications of the Green Movement at the time, they were quite proud of some of these people who got into fights with police and other security forces, sort of lionizing them as heroes. So maybe it's a case of like the aging footballer trying to high-five the younger player, current player, sort of saying we're all on the same team and have the same experiences and get back a little taste of his youth.
Yeah, the Green Party is a real mixed bag. It had its origin in violence, including many Nazis were involved in the founding of the Green Party. There's been a lot of work done on this. On the other hand, there are folks there who have criticized modern anti-Semitism in the Federal Republic. So it's a real mixed bag. But there are, on the continent here in Europe, the left largely dominates. I mean, although there's a conservative government in Germany, in the UK, we've seen a major shift, I think, over the last 10 to 15 years into the direction of political social democracy, even among the conservative parties.
Doesn't it seem as if the left in Europe has great institutional power? It still has the trade unions, especially in Germany and in France, but in many parts of the continent. And there's enormous cultural power, both in the media, the universities, and so on. And against that, you have sort of the broad European middle class, which is sort of worried about slow growth and falling educational standards and immigration and rising crime. And these are two, you know, very different groups pitted against each other, sort of the middle of the middle class in Germany and elsewhere against these institutional powers. So the middle class is numerous enough to elect someone like Merkel, but not populated enough at the cultural elite level to get any intellectual argument going.
Right. I mean, you have, for example, there was a big anti-Semitism scandal here in Germany involving Jakob Augstein, who's a major stockholder in the Spiegel magazine, who accused the United States and Israel of causing all the violence in the Middle East since the so-called Arab Spring took place, and charging the U.S. Republican Party with stoking violence in the Middle East. And this was what he wrote in his Spiegel columns, one of, you know, the most influential magazines here. Finally, the Simon Wiesenthal Center placed him on their list of the top 10 anti-Semitic, anti-Israeli slurs at the end of 2012. And there was a huge debate here in January, and most of the journalistic class defended him. There were some exceptions, but that shows you, I think, the sort of monolithic view here when someone's voicing these types of comments, that in the mainstream press in the United States would be viewed as, you know, an expression of contemporary anti-Semitism and just fierce anti-Americanism.
Yes, it's amazing how often these various types of intolerance go together. We've been talking with Benjamin Weinthal, a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, talking about how Hezbollah has got surprisingly strong and broad support across Europe, and that's a worrying thing for America and for decent people everywhere. Benjamin Weinthal, thanks for joining us on Secure Freedom Radio. This is Richard Miniter filling in for Frank Gaffney.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This hurricane season, coastal residents in the Southeast and the Gulf states are urged to prepare for the uncertain conditions they may encounter in the aftermath of a major storm and make their annual contingency plans. In addition to other emergency essentials, the American Red Cross and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security recommend residents keep a diversified emergency wallet that includes cash and traveler's checks. American Express traveler's checks provide an extra measure of financial safety and security. Keeping traveler's checks and a supply of cash in small bills offers storm victims payment options to make necessary purchases. Traveler's checks never expire, providing a secure payment method whenever emergencies occur, this year and in the future. Unlike cash, they're refundable if lost or stolen. American Express traveler's checks are available at banks, credit unions, and American Express travel service locations across the Gulf Coast and Southeast regions. For more information, please visit www.americanexpress.com/traveler's checks.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat and listen to the Gospel.
I just got
to
stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew, as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need, and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This is Richard Miniter filling in for Frank Gaffney. I'm joined now by Adam Credo, who's a senior writer for the Washington Free Beacon, one of those great investigative websites in the Washington area, of course, reaching out to the world. And Adam Credo has, formerly of Washington Jewish Week, by the way, where he was an award-winning reporter, has a frightening and sad article, really, that it's really important to talk about today. It's called This Blood Libel, Brought to You by the West. Adam, there's a Palestinian nonprofit group founded by Hanan Ashrawi called MIFTA, definitely not Mitzvah, in which it blames, it says that it asks the question whether Obama knows Christian blood, I mean, presumably the blood of babies, if it's the classic blood libel, is used in the Jewish Passover. First of all, when would these old lies go away? And second of all, why is the U.S. taxpayer supporting a group that's willing to say such hateful things?
They're both good questions, and I don't think this is going to go away anytime soon. Of course, these types of blood libels and rumors about the Jews have existed for decades, and they are incredibly resilient in the Arab world in particular. And when they're perpetuated by groups such as these, they just take on a whole new life and really continue to spread. But this group is particularly interesting, MISTA, because it's been boosted by a lot of Western governments. The U.S. funded it through the NED.
That's the National Endowment for Democracy. And gets several hundred million dollars a year and is run by people from the Democratic Party, and the Republicans have their own sort of taxpayer-funded think tank called the IRI, or International Republican Institute. But only the Democratic one is funding MIFTA, the Palestinian group putting out this blood libel.
That's right, and was a large funder of the organization until at least 2010. They've cut ties for some reason, though. They won't explain to me why exactly that is, but a lot of other Western governments, particularly in Europe, have funded this organization. And this article that they published, and they took it down following criticism, but this isn't the first time they've gotten themselves into hot water. They've accused Israel of massacres, of genocide, things such as this, and they've published articles praising terrorists, particularly female terrorists. So it's kind of what the organization's been doing, even though it's boosted by the West as kind of this emblem of Palestinian reformation, and that's supposedly what the group does. But publishing articles accusing Jews of drinking Christian blood is really more in line with a lot of what we see in the Arab world.
And we should say that 30 to 35, sometimes 40%, depending on your estimates, of Palestinians are actually Christian. So that's why this rumor works in their audience, is that somewhere between a quarter and a half of them are going to have relatives who are Christian and will get incensed by this if they believe it. So it's, we kind of have this blanket or monolithic understanding of Palestinians as Muslims. Many, many of them are, but not all, including Yasser Arafat's wife was Christian. Or still is Christian, in fact. So there is many leaders in the Palestinian movement who are Christian, who for this blood libel still works. This blood libel, by the way, that Jews mix Christian blood into the matzah, is something that comes out of Tsarist Russia. I mean, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, if memory serves.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, and it's really a rumor that swirled around for years and years, and you're right, because a large percent of Arabs in the Arab world are, in fact, Christian. This is a good way to unite behind hating Jews and Jewish people. It's a particularly pernicious rumor and blood libel that's circulated, and you're right, in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and a lot of other texts, which are still widely read and circulated in the Arab world. I've seen some recent studies about how popular the book continues to be. But I think what's most interesting about this MIFTA organization perpetuating it is the fact that it has such backing from the West. The Ford Foundation has funded them. UNESCO, the United Nations, has worked with them, and they actually distance themselves from this organization. To me earlier today, UNESCO spokesperson there told me that they condemn this flat out and don't do any work with them anymore. So you really see a lot of these Western groups trying to get away from what MIFTA is doing right now.
And you still see, even though Europe is in the midst of an enormous financial crisis, bailing out Cyprus and maybe Slovenia will be next, and of course Italy, Ireland, Spain have their own troubles, and yet each of these European governments, as well as the European Union itself, continues to fund Palestinian organizations like this. And according to your article, it looks like MIFTA is also funded by several European governments. You think they'd have enough trouble at home without funding extremism abroad.
That's absolutely right, but these governments continue to allocate money to these types of organizations. It's a big cause in Europe, and a lot of Palestinian organizations such as MIFTA, which put themselves out as a beacon of reformation of doing this type of work, they receive large amounts of their funding from the West and particularly Europe for these reasons. But behind the scenes, they're doing things such as this. Now, what's interesting about MIFTA's article, it was in Arabic. The apologies, however, are in English, and I've seen no apology in Arabic. So you got to ask and wonder who exactly is the audience at this apology is for.
Have you asked MIFTA why they haven't apologized in Arabic?
You know, I have put out the request to them. They haven't gotten back to me, and they haven't really maintained much opposition to this except from what they've posted on their website. I haven't seen them speak to the press, although I'd really like them to, because I have a bunch of questions I'd like to ask them. And what's also kind of curious here is that the organization first defended itself from these attacks. There was a blogger, the Elder of Zion, who is a pro-Israel blogger, and pointed out what MIFTA had done. They attacked him as attacking them, actually, to begin with. And then yesterday I issued the apology, I guess, once pressure got too great for them.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, have you talked to any of the funders of MIFTA or the former funders and asked if they are planning to put pressure on the organization to apologize in Arabic?
You know, I sent out a bunch of press requests to many of the major funders. Most of them did not get back. UNESCO, as I mentioned, did and said that they don't work with them anymore and condemn this, which is a good first step. But we've seen the NED. They told me that they don't work with them anymore. But like I mentioned, won't explain why they stopped funding them. You have to imagine that it might be because of this type of behavior.
Well, could, as the current head of the NED, willing to call on MIFTA, its former grantee, to apologize in Arabic?
Well, what they haven't so far, but that's really where the pressure needs to come from. Once the people who have the fiscal means to support this type of organization actually put pressure on it to be accountable for this type of rhetoric, that's when we'll see actual change. I think till that point, just people like me publishing articles and putting out the calls, I'm not sure that's enough to really get a change in behavior.
Well, we have a lot of listeners here at Secure Freedom Radio. Is there anything that the listeners can do to join this effort to get MIFTA to apologize and to get some of their European and American donors to cut funding and cut ties with this extremist organization?
Well, look, I think there's a lot of things that people can do. Actually, you know, promoting these types of things and mentioning that it's taking place and putting the pressure on the organization to, hey, say something. You take my money that I generously donate to you, and this is what you're funding. I mean, the pressure can very much come from the grassroots if people are willing to invest the time to make this an issue. And it's certainly important enough to be, because it's such just a terrible, disgusting lie that circulates about Jewish people. And of course, it's completely untrue. And I think the real insidious thing about the MIFTA article is that it says outright, you may have heard this is fake and not true, but in fact, it is true. So they're trying to frame it in that way.
That's even more disturbing. Does anyone in the world, even the Maasai who drink the blood of cows as part of their regular diet, does anyone in the world eat bread mixed with blood? I mean, it's just an insane lie, and yet it's one that we repeatedly hear against Jewish people simply to whip up hatred. And the idea that any U.S. taxpayer-funded entity would fund an organization that would think it makes editorial sense to put something like this out there, especially in a combustible part of the world like Israel, is simply amazing. Who is the current head of the National Endowment for Democracy?
That's a good question. I've only reached out through their spokesperson. I don't know the head by name, but it would be good to get on their website. They list all of their officials up there. I know they're spokesperson is a woman named Jane, and she's been helpful in getting back to me. A lot of these people, however, have also been on vacation, so the article hasn't gotten the due attention from these organizations for that reason. Between Easter and Passover, a lot of Jewish people are off as well, so I think that helped actually perpetuate this article, allow it to be out there without the type of reaction that it deserves.
Well, I mean, people could certainly contact the National Endowment for Democracy, which, again, is funded by hundreds of millions of U.S. Taxpayer dollars, and reach out to that person and demand that MIFTA, which has been putting out these terrible blood libels against Jews, that they apologize in Arabic and desist from anything like this in the future. We've been talking to Adam Credo. You can find Adam Credo's work at the Washington Free Beacon. With this and many other important stories can be found. This is Richard Miniter filling in for Frank Gaffney.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.